CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. Stream us anytime at www.ciut.fm.
Welcome to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and we're going to be speaking shortly with John Philpott, a lawyer in Montreal. He represented clients at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Later in the show, we'll be talking with, talking about such things as the Carney visit to Ukraine. I think he is going to be come back and announce that there will be peace in our time, something of that order. The Rwanda story is very important because it's an ongoing one. If you start with today's news, that Rwanda is among those three or four states in Africa that are accepting deportees from the United States. What is most noticeable about this process is that each of the states that is doing so is very much beholden to the U.S. And it, there are those who champion the Rwanda as some type of, power and independent African state, but it is actually the most obedient of the those who follow American authority. Trump helped in a negotiated deal in the Congo, which is going to be apropos of what we're going to be talking about today, but it just needs to be known of why we need to be talking in an informed way about how the crisis in the Great Lakes region evolved. And it's a long story and a short one, but short in the sense that the people who do public relations and rationalize policy I would call them sordid, sensational headlines, which do not tell you anything about what actually happened or is happening. But the long-term issue is U.S. hegemony in the region, and they're continually pressing matters in order to conquer territory through surrogates, but particularly on the border of Congo and Rwanda. In eastern Congo, one of the most mineral-rich areas of the world, has everything from uranium to rare earth to diamonds. And in this region, there is an armed group called M23. It operates under the tutelage of the Rwandan government, and they've been on Congolese soil pretty much for 30 years. And there's been recently was one of Trump's peace deals, probably an illusion, but the key element of it is that Donald Trump points out, as he always does with his peace deals, that the United States will profit, literally, make money. They will get contracts. So when he says Congo and Rwanda have signed an agreement to try to end the fighting, actually what he's saying is, well, I shouldn't say actually, he always adds that the U.S., of course, it's their mediation that created the situation, and also that the parties have agreed to make available their minerals to the U.S., the U.S. contractors, in every spot that these peace deals occur. But it's very relevant to our conversation today with Montreal lawyer, international criminal lawyer, John Philpott. Are you there, John?
Yes, Phil. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be talking to you. Your client was a rather great figure in the modern history of Rwanda, is Protez Zigiranurazo. And listeners to this program and those who followed events in Rwanda developed an opinion, a view of your client, who recently passed, by the way, and that's one of the reasons we're talking to you today. But in formulating a sort of a propaganda picture of the terrible events of 1994, there were a couple of terms used, but probably the most telling one was that the allegation was that there was a tiny group of Hutu extremists, and they were identified as the Akazu, and the central name in the Akazu group was your client Protez. They gave him the nickname Mr. Z. I don't know how many people realize, but you conducted, along with Peter Zadek, a great defense, and your client was acquitted. And now, of course, he's tragically died in Niger without the story being quite understood. And I guess I'll add one other name here. We want the world to know about this acquittal. We want them to understand who Zigiranurazo was. But his sister was Madame Habyarimana, and she has lived under the accusation in France, under the accusation that she too was perhaps, and it might have been the key to this group called the Akazu. And something has happened in her case. I'd like you to talk about both. How widely is it known that Protez was acquitted, cleared of the charge?
It's very enlightening and interesting, because Protez Zigiranurazo had been a prefect of the Ruwengeri prefecture, and he had been a diplomat in the past, and he was the brother-in-law of the president who was assassinated on the 6th of April, 1994. Now, the story goes that beginning in 1991, there was some inter-ethnic violence when the RPF, the Tutsi-dominated force from Uganda, part of the Ugandan army, started invading as of the 1st of October, 1990. There was some inter-ethnic violence in Rwanda. And so the opposition parties, who at that time were cooperating with the Rwandan Patriotic Front Ugandan invaders, said, oh, this was caused by a little group around the president, and it's the Akazu, and it's called a small hut, and that's sort of the translation. And they're saying that these people promoted and organized the persecution of Tutsis in Rwanda. Now, that wasn't true, of course, but it became the common kind of discourse which dominated in part in Rwanda and in part internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Zigiranurazo was under this cloud of being a member of the Akazu. At that time, he was actually in Canada studying. And he was actually expelled from Canada because when a judge said he killed them, killed their friends, which is not true also. And so what happened is that he got charged by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and they vetted about four or five events where he was on a roadblock and had people killed, and they alleged a meeting on the 8th of February 1994 where they sat down and planned killings. And this was the Akazu which conspired. Well, we had a very large Peter Zadek, and I did a pretty good job, I think. But we also had a
lot
of support.
You won the case.
Yeah, but we had a lot of support, and a lot of people came, and the opposition parties, who had been playing both sides during 1991-92, came and testified at Mr. Zigaran Yerhetzel's trial, saying, we invented this concept of Akazu to discredit the Habyarimana government. So the Akazu as a conspiratorial group did not conspire, and everybody realized that, and Mr. Zigaran Yerhetzel was acquitted of this charge, which historically is quite important for the history of the so-called genocide or this war in Rwanda, which was a very sad and terrible mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. But the Akazu theory was debunked, mm-hmm. all right, as a cause. The family of the Habyarimana family came largely to testify. The opposition testified. And the second aspect of, I call him Prote because everyone calls him Prote. I'm sorry to, anyway, I don't want to be all too familiar, but I call him Prote.
People, everybody trips over his name in the Sierra One.
Yes. And they alleged that he was on a hill in the northwestern Rwanda, where people were killed on a hill, and on the 9th of April, 3 days after the shooting down of the plane, where there was ethnic violence after that. But he was in mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, mourning, mm-hmm. at the Habyarimana home in Kanambi, in the outskirts of Kigali. Mm-hmm. And so he had an alibi for these mm-hmm. major allegations against him, and the alibi with other elements of the evidence stood up, so he was not found guilty of this major violence which happened in part on the 9th of April 1994 after the murder mm-hmm. of President Habyarimana. So and on the 9th, Mrs. Habyarimana, we call her Mrs. Agathe Kanziga is her name, actually. She left Rwanda on the 9th to go to, she went to, ended up in Europe a week later. But, so this was a kind of mm-hmm. a major breakthrough in the legal situation of a large number of people, because this story fell apart. I must say, to the credit of many of the other accused and their lawyers, a lot of very important trials were lost by the prosecutor. So, anyway, this was a success, and Prote won that part of it. He didn't win everything at trial. On appeal, he was finally acquitted. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, and we should mention, by the way, some were acquitted right at trial. I mean, by the way, they really threw the book at them, and the book was always conspiracy, and several major military leaders were just flat out acquitted because they never made this case at all.
Well, just in fact, I was I had dinner last night with the family of Mr. Bagasora, who was acquitted of conspiracy.
Let's remind listeners that again, if people think they know what happened in Rwanda in 1994, along with Akazu, they would know the name Bagasora, because the literature here always focused on him, and indeed the main judge of the court referred to him when he was arrested as the big fish. And then he was accused of conspiracy, and he was cleared of that.
And Romeo Dallaire said, "I shook hands with the devil." this is the way that mythology in Canada.
I love that story because, of course, the devil that he shook hands with was a Rwandan banker who was not a guy in camo running around the streets. He was actually a Rwandan banker, and he had come to meet Dallaire at the invitation of Dallaire. And Bagosora was the intermediary, because Dallaire said, I want to meet one of these people who represent the youth group. He didn't call them youth group, I guess. The Interahamwe. And so, lo and behold, the vice president he met was a major figure in Rwandan banking, and not at all, was the figure we assume would be at a roadblock with a machete. And yet Dallaire called him the devil.
Right.
And let's get to the, I want to clear something really important. I think your case, that trial, for people who, again, I understand people will say, be skeptical or worried, because this was a major story, and it was always genocide, and conspiracy to commit. In universities, I'm sure, and where people give learned lectures on this subject, they say, well, in order to understand this, you must read Alison DeForge, her tome called Leave None to Tell the Story. And you can follow her because she's the one who knows. Well, she appeared in your trial as a witness for the prosecution. And if anybody had created the story of the conspiracy, it was her. And she believed in the Akazu and the other business. So what happened? I'll leave it to you to talk about it. But conspiracy was alleged against your client, and she's the authority on conspiracy.
Her story did not stand up about a group of people around the president's family conspiring to cause the genocide. And I recall her cross-examining her, and you know about that. She couldn't answer any questions. She's an expert. Experts are supposed to know, be able to answer questions. She had not studied anything since she first wrote her book. So she was not accepted, and that's major importance, because as many people say, she was the mother of the tribunal. She and the tribunal took its a lot of its thinking and prosecutions from her book, and it didn't stand up.
Yes.
There's another factor which is actually quite interesting right now, is that Mrs. Kanziga, which is Protea's sister-in-law,
wife of the president,
the wife of the president, has been living in Paris since I think the 17th of April 1994. I could be wrong by a day or two there. Okay, and she's been charged and tried to be charged and had investigations continually since then. Like, that's more than 30 years. I don't know when they started. I think they started the investigations against her in 2003, subject to being corrected on the dates. I didn't verify those dates. But she has been well defended by her lawyer, Philippe Mayac, and she got 4 or 5 days ago what's called a non-lieu in French, which means no case to answer. All right? In other words, the case was rejected by the French court.
When we would use dismissed, right?
Dismissed, but they can still go on appeal. They're going on appeal. I don't think that'll go very far. But
yeah, go ahead.
And ironically, the judgment is confidential, but I understand from what I've been informed of is that the whole theory of the Akazu was debunked also in that judgment, and she was considered a victim of the war and not a protagonist.
A victim by who? Now, who's saying that?
Because the family was killed. Her husband was killed and she had to leave. So that would imply the RPF. It didn't say that in those, I don't think it said that in those words.
But I guess we can call it a judgment or finding, regards her as a victim of the process, right?
Yes, exactly. So, unfortunately, of course, is that the legal system is a little bit late. as they were with respect to Protezigarinyuatso, because...
It won't be a victory till the world understands this.
For sure.
That a false accusation was made and was put on the front pages of newspapers all over the world, and the person's acquitted, but as they say, you don't get your reputation back because you've been smeared.
But the tribunal at that time in 2012, on their website, they still had the Akazu story of a conspiring to cause genocide, even though Proti was acquitted in November 2009. So that's quite shocking. And the other, of course, part of this is that many of the acquitted or released, some men finished their terms of prison, many were acquitted, were kept in a safe house in Arusha, and on the 5th of December 2021, the tribunal got them the right to live in Niger, which is a country in West Africa, kind of a hot country. It's a very interesting country. It's not necessarily the Rwandan environment, where it's just...
Not at all.
Right. So they were there, and 3 weeks later, their papers were withdrawn, apparently because of pressure from France or Kagame, and they were in limbo, legal limbo, from then until now. And these men live in a house and can't go out without an escort, don't have identity cards,
mm-hmm.
and several have died, including Mr. Zigaranyuatso on the 3rd of August. Mm-hmm. And who is refusing their presence? The Western countries, Canada, France, Luxembourg, Belgium, is refusing these people to go and be with their families.
And you attempted to take some steps to correct that. What did you do?
I applied to the court under a principle of, it's called statu quo ante, which means put them back where you picked them up. In other words, they picked them
exactly.
up in the airport in Brussels. You arrested him, put him back there, and he can try for his refugee status or whatever he can apply, try and get his papers. Mm. Obviously, they didn't accept that. All right? And I have to say something. In our modern world, who persecutes Rwandans and tries them? Either refuses them to come to their country or runs trials. The liberal West, France, Germany, Finland, USA, Canada. And the so-called authoritarian countries, which are China, Russia, Iran, other, don't charge Rwandans. So let's just think about what people think about human rights. Because Rwandans are persecuted by the West, and the West is the so-called human rights bastion, which is, mm-hmm. I don't share that point of view, but it's food for thought for many of us when we think of human rights. And now I'm getting a bit off topic, but these are things which I'm sure in the Taylor Report your listeners hear about very often.
Mm-hmm. How many years was he in custody?
He was in custody from June 2002, and he was out of custody on November 16th, 2009. So that's about 7 years, a little over 7 years.
And then
they
put him in the United Nations gulag limbo.
And he was half free and half not free. In other words, he could walk around the city, but he didn't have identity papers.
Well, where could he go? What kind of papers did he have?
He didn't have papers. He had a little paper from the tribunal saying he was under their authority, but he didn't have residential papers in Tanzania, and so he couldn't have a bank account.
Yeah.
He could walk around the city. He could visit the city and go out. He wasn't forced to be.
Well, he's in a foreign city, not his climate, not his people. And he's able to walk. I mean, to me, that is almost like limbo itself as conceived by the Catholic Church.
For sure.
You don't have...
Horrible.
Where's your family? Where are your friends? Where's anything?
You can't go anywhere. And there's a story of one man from Arusha, an acquitted prisoner, who tried to go... to leave Tanzania and to get into Burundi. and he got to the border, and somehow he got caught, and he was taken back to Tanzania, but he almost made it into Burundi. I don't know whether you know that story, but it's a true story.
Well, it is a maddening situation, because where are the great champions who wanted this court? And by the way, one of those who led the charge in calling for this ICTR to be, you know, bring quality justice. I recall the expression of Africa suffers from a culture of impunity. They have to have a real court. So, and one of these was Alison DeForge of Human Rights Watch. So what do they say now about people who are acquitted and can't go home?
They don't talk about it, Bill. They don't talk about it, and these are things which have to be raised in all forums. It's like 20 or 30 years ago. It was on everybody's mind. Even now, I am working with Palestinian organizations here in defense, as a defense lawyer, and some of the people who come to support the accused have told me, I said, well, you know, by the way, the story about Rwanda wasn't exactly true. Mm-hmm. A young woman who's 28, she said, I explained a bit to her, and she said, well, we learned the opposite in school.
Fortunately, you had the author. People really have to, it seems to me the thing really so striking, you had Alison DeForge herself, and she was a sort of the ace that the prosecution played. She testified in many cases, and they said, well, here comes Alison. I once heard the head of the court say to her, we can refuse you nothing, because she'd made a little request. She said, I'm scheduled to testify on Monday, but I have an appointment, oddly enough, in Rwanda. And she said, I would like to be excused from that. And the Judge Kama said to her, I can refuse you nothing. So there she was, the great author, the one who called for this court, and she's in your courtroom for the prosecution, telling them that there was an Akazu and that Mr. Z was a member of it, and the court didn't believe her. But the world doesn't know that that was a failure, a terrible, embarrassing failure. Which, by the way, they should pull the book off the shelves and say, well, we need to correct our book here.
For sure.
Let's talk, by the way, let me just ask you about the quality of her testimony, because I've on several occasions, of course, I worked there as an investigator for Charles and David Jacobson, Defend Dixon, and a number of others, and yourself, full disclosure. She, in order to talk about the Akazu, when she was questioned, I recall, by a judge about, well, how do we show that the president's wife was involved in these things when we don't see any, you know, particular evidence here? And her answer was like somebody telling folk stories. She said, well, you know, in Rwandan history, the wife of the king often gives instructions from behind the curtain. And you say, well, that's not very compelling, actually. We're talking about Mr. Protez Zigiranyirazo. What evidence, you know, to me it was so nakedly stupid. I mean, that she was going to reach into her bag and start telling stories from Rwandan history. Meanwhile, she's there testifying about a living human being against whom they weren't able to bring that evidence.
Criminal charges, not just of murder, of genocide, which is worse than just murder.
Yeah, it's conspiring.
And she had nothing to offer. And as a lawyer, what I found shocking, and everyone would have a different experience, I tried to ask her about her studies since she wrote her book. She had done nothing. There was a lot of alternative explanations which were heading towards a more accurate evaluation of the so-called Rwandan genocide. She hadn't read them. So she was not an expert, in my opinion. I don't see her as an expert. An expert in medical or issues or engineering knows all the literature and can explain why things are should be interpreted this way.
By the way, isn't she also, and you noticed this, the experts who came, Philip Rentjens came, there was a gentleman from Belgium who, by the way, testified once for the prosecution. I think later he wanted to testify for the defense because his opinions flipped over. But what's noticeable is that there was no African who was considered an expert. There was no Rwandan scholar, and I mean Rwandan, or someone who might have been qualified, say, Burundi, Rwanda, since these are demographically the same people. And they had to have white Europeans because the story was being projected back to Europe. We've got these bad Africans and we're punishing them, and we brought experts. So the expert is a woman who is a sub-professor at a university in Buffalo, and she's the encyclopedia on Rwanda. The absurdity of that never struck anyone here.
It's shocking. Well, I mean, this is a bad joke, but one of the experts, Ferdinand Nahimana of Rwandan history, was convicted of genocide. Yeah.
A scholar with publications and status. He's convicted. On the matter,
he's living in Mali, and he can't go and see his family, who live in Europe.
One of the early cases was the Interahamwe case, defended by Tiffen Dixon and Rutaganda George, and they brought Rentjens, and it was they were just bringing a name, because when he got to stood to testify, he said, "Actually, I'm not an authority on the Interahamwe. I don't really know much about them. My expertise is in the laws of Rwanda." He had helped write the constitution of Rwanda, the one administered by President Habyarimana himself. But because they wanted a European to make it all believable to Europeans, they brought him. I do appreciate that he said openly, and it was almost a confession to the court, he said, "I actually don't know much about this." He was helpful in another way. He said, they asked him, "Well, when did the genocide end?" And he said, "It hasn't ended," because he said the current government is committing genocide. And they never called him back, by the way. That was his last moment. It strikes me, John, that we're in a position to now demand a re-examination of history, presenting the arguments. Oh, and let me just mention, in the case in France, I read that they reviewed the ICTR files.
Yes.
I would assume that they must have looked at your trial defending Madame Habyarimana's brother.
They do that. At the trials, actually, and this goes beyond Madame Kanziga, but at the trials in France, they do report on the ICTR. Although not very accurately, because the ICTR, speaking as a, how can you say, as a legal experiment, was not overly successful.
Putting it mildly.
In obtaining what the planners wanted, which is over strong convictions, which, you know, would mark the history of that part of Africa for forever. They didn't get those convictions. They had a few of them. I'm not trying to say it was a good court, but the resistance to them was so strong that there was some success in debunking the lies. But that's how I see it. I don't know whether you see
it. If they reviewed your case, it would have had to help them in determining that there was no Akazu.
For sure, yep. And that's a factor, and I can inform your listeners that I actually collaborate closely with the lawyer from Mrs. Kanziga. We discuss, and for the last 10-15 years, I've been working closely with him on her case, although he knows the case, and I don't know her case that well, but I've been helping him with information, witnesses, and things like that.
Let's call attention to the crisis of those who remain in, I guess the term that people would understand is a halfway house. The United Nations Tribunal put them on trial, and Some have completed their, were convicted and completed their sentences. Others were acquitted. Can you sort of give us a picture? Where are they now?
Yes.
And
they were.
Go ahead.
Yes, of course. Tanzania did not want to keep them. They had no obligation to. It would have been maybe nice that they could stay there, but it wasn't their obligation. So the UN negotiated to put them into Niger, which in 2021 was a close ally of France and the U.S. It no longer so. And they were sent to a safe house there, and they were given documentation and like an identity card, and they could go to a bank, they could open a bank account, they could maybe travel in the region depending on what the rules were.
This is Tanzania. And,
I'm not talking about Niger. They've arrived
in Niger. All right.
As of the 5th of December, 2021. At the time, there was 8 of them. Now there's 5 left. Five left.
Mm-hmm.
3 have died.
How many of those have been acquitted, were acquitted people?
About 4 and 4. Mm-hmm. 4 acquitted and 4 who've done their time.
So, Thomas, in one instance, 4 people who were innocent, were acquitted of charges.
Yes. And they're living in Niger, and they cannot go out of their house except with military accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have access to a bank. They cannot travel to Ivory Coast, to a country nearby. I know because Prote had a daughter who lived in Ivory Coast. He could have gone and lived there if he had papers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like twiddling your thumbs. they're stuck in that house. They get up every day. They eat, and they worry. And some of them, and we have to get into the human side of it. Some of them are 61 or 62 or 63 years old. In other words, they're men who are very able to lead a full life if they were in Europe or in another country. Papers.
Mm-hmm.
They have lots of possibilities. But no, they're just.
And there's one woman, by the way.
She's not there. She's
I know, but I want to talk about all those places. That's the other bizarre thing. They're not kept in one place. They're scattered.
They're in Senegal. She's in Senegal, Madame Nira Mira Suhuko. And a good number of them are in Senegal, and another group of them are in Benin. And it's extremely difficult for them now, particularly in Benin right now, because these men all have their material, on their computers, because
mm-hmm.
they were allowed to bring computers when they left Arusha, and now Benin has deprived them of their computers, which have all the recourse to revise their cases, because they all know that most of the convictions, if not all, were based on false evidence,
mm-hmm.
and they want to reopen their cases, and now their computers have been taken away by the administration of Benin, prison administration of Benin, which...
And why can't the United Nations intervene on their behalf?
This is a subject of a lot of dispute and litigation, which has been unsuccessful to date, to try and get them back, because... There's been some orders by the court, but the administration of Benin has not cooperated with the administration. And this is confidential material. It's all the material which is held in their computers is confidential, including protected witnesses, for example, which is considered to be a major issue for the tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
And all my correspondence with my clients who are in prison is actually in their computers,
mm-hmm.
and they want to give them to their families or but it's all confidential material. It's all private confidential material, which should not be released, of course. So, and these men also, when you're wrongly convicted, my perception of this issue is that convicted persons dream of being vindicated. And all these men that I know 3 of them quite well, and they all dream of being vindicated and reversing their conviction because of the honor, their own personal honor, and the honor of their families.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a, how can I say, a continuation of the manifest injustice meted out to these men. There's another thing which I think you know about this, but most people who get a sentence of 25 years are released after two-thirds.
Mm-hmm.
And originally in this tribunal, many of the earlier people who finished had done two-thirds of their sentences had been released, and now they're not releasing them. And they're just spending the rest of their lives in prison when they should be getting out.
Yeah.
And this is another issue which will have to, it's being addressed. I'm not saying it's being addressed satisfactorily, but it's being addressed. And we have to continue on that struggle. And we are going to take this issue to an organization which is called the African Bar Association,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm a member of. And we're going to raise this issue at mm-hmm. a conference in Ghana in the next next weeks, October.
Well, across Africa, there is skepticism about these tribunals, and the ICTR would be Exhibit A, because the mindset seems to be basically colonial. They set up a tribunal in the name of the most advanced justice, and I go back to it. They said they were going to end the culture of impunity in Africa through this tribunal, which is why they were holding it in Africa.
I completely agree with you, and I'm not sure that this the so-called international community, which is a misnomer, but I don't think that these international courts have a future. These international ad hoc courts controlled by the Security Council have a serious future in the next, say, 10 or 20 years.
Oh, absolutely. No, I agree with you.
I don't think that the...
It's been so politicized and poisoned, and its motives are so clear that country after country is going to reject it in self-defense of their nationals. John, it's been very enlightening. We do appreciate your sharing all this. I think we want to keep coming back to this, and I'm more and more convinced that the case of Protez is one of those which is going to demolish the old theories concocted in the West about what happened in Rwanda in 1994. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Bill, and it's nice talking to you. And I will distribute the record of this media of this to a large number of people in the Rwanda community. Thank you.
Well, thank you. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, and I think we probably have a little appropriate music as chosen by Pedro, and we will come back.